Okay. Let's see. Should we wait a few more minutes before to see if anyone else turns up? I thought I saw Hunter. Oh, no, Hunter's at the back. Right, cool. Oh, I knew Ali was going to drop by. Who else is around? Look, there's an Aaron. Why am I in a meeting? Oh, I guess this is the meeting. Okay, I'm going to try something a little scary, at least for me. So let me just see if it works. Please work. Yeah, it's not working. Okay. Few more people just wandering in. So when you say you're recording it, is it recording me now? No. Does it show like Gathertown, or does it show my feed, or what does it show?
Oh, Hannah, I can't hear you.
It's just recording my browser, basically.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
Gather doesn't have a native recording
situation. No, that's what I was thinking. Well, I mean,
we'll see if this works today, and if it doesn't,
this is sort of an experiment in so many different ways. So I'm totally okay. I'm just gonna try and lower everyone's expectations a little bit. I didn't even brush my hair. So okay. Well, I think that's enough, people. And okay, can everyone see my slides?
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. I suggest putting the slides or the whole thing to full screen, because to explain a little bit about why you should lower expectations, this is actually the second version of this talk. I gave a similar talk with a little bit more technical detail at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and I was kind of disappointed by it, because part of what this talk is an attempt to do is to convey my excited enthusiasm about some of the aspects in artificial intelligence. And the consequence of the last talk I gave was everyone thought it was very funny, but wasn't particularly interested in the software I was using, the tools. So, and I've thought about this for a while, because it is kind of funny. And in fact, one of the things that I won't be showing you on this is the reason why I got excited about this, which is that I discovered that some of the later technology I'm going to talk about is actually quite good at writing jokes, which used to be my job at one point. I was a jobbing joke writer. And it's an utterly oppressive craft, because you have to sit there in the writer's room and turn out like 20 or 30 jokes a day. And they're all terrible, except for one that they might use. And I realized that this program was actually much better at generating these jokes than I ever was. I mean, most of them were terrible, but that didn't matter, right? Because most of the jokes that anybody writes is terrible. But of course, it was a machine writing it, so I could just have it working on this 24 hours a day. Apart from going back in time and like making, must be 30 quid a day by having this computer do it. It did really make me think about the implications of this whole thing. And so I've been puzzling about like why it didn't really... A couple of people in the talk did go off and play around with the stuff I'm going to show you. They mainly used it to write plays about Elon Musk, which I think is timely and somewhat interesting. But I was also kind of hoping people would go away and play around with the applications. And I realized that one of the reasons why people didn't do it is... kind of a fundamental challenge with technology as a whole, which is I really profoundly think that technology is something that when you or digital technology at least is when you experience it, it has an effect on you. I think there's an old Stuart Brand line about we make buildings and afterwards they make ours, and there's this sort of weird conversation between technology and human beings. You have an interaction with them, and their possibilities, even though they're not very human possibilities sometimes, but their capabilities make you think about the world differently. And of course, your presumptions about the world also affect the technology. And so unless you actually, so the way I think about it is that it's a bit like me showing pictures of my cat and then playing a little video of me talking to my cat. And it's sort of vaguely entertaining, but it doesn't really give you that impression of like playing with a pet, right? Actually having an interaction with a pet. And the other thing is, of course, talking with an animal, you know, there's no implication here that you're talking to them. That conversation is the same as talking to a human being. But it does have this strange bidirectionality to it. We are in some ways projecting humanity onto our pets, right? We're talking to them as though they were like strange, small, furry human beings. And they talk back in many ways because they've sort of evolved and been cultured to behave in that way. But the important thing, all of that kind of high level conversation doesn't really explain what that relationship is and what changes about you and what changes about with an animal when you have a tiny version of them in your home. So anyway, sort of lower some expectations here. I hope to show you some elements of what's been going on in the last 60 years. First of all, I'm just going to show you pictures of cats, basically, which is a really good slideshow. Actually, what I'm going to do is show you slightly too many sort of almost holiday pictures from the 1950s. And that was another rat hole I went into, right? There's a small enough number of you here that I can sort of show you the skeletal machinery of how I'm trying to turn this talk around. I can't show you the conversation, but I just to make sure that you do stay around for an hour, will be a little opportunity to have a conversation with the computer at the end and after that too. So with all of that given, I'm going to just do the first 20 minutes. I'm going to spend telling you gossip, and like, I feel sorry for Ali because Ali was like, oh my God, anthropology. I love anthropology. And this is the worst kind of cultural anthropology, which is basically gossip. And if you talk to any anthropologist drunk, and they will tell you that they are basically collectors of gossip. So I always say anthropology just to make it sound a little bit better. But in the meantime, I'm just going to give you some of that cultural background, because people have been talking to their computers for over 60 years, and that's had an effect both on the technology we use, and also, I really fundamentally, as I say, feel that that's had an impact on the people, and the subset of people who get to talk to machines is kind of important too. So artificial intelligence, for those of you who don't know, and I promise if you do know all of this, I'll try and inject as much like gossip that you haven't heard before, was invented in 1952 at the Dartmouth workshop. This was brought together by John McCarthy, godfather of Lisp, a man with amazing hair, as we'll see. I love this sort of, if you can read it, if you can't read it, shout out, because like I've got a lot of small fonts coming up. I love the phrase here, we think we can, a significant advance can be made in one or more of these problems if a carefully selected group of scientists work on it together for a summer. It turns out creating artificial intelligence, at least human level intelligence, takes a little bit longer than a summer. And a little bit more than 10 men as you will see at the top. It's a 2-month, 10-man study. But the truth is that some of the really sort of pioneering figures in artificial intelligence met, and really in some ways, and this is such a platitudinous thing to talk about academic research, but in many ways the whole field of artificial intelligence is just continuing the conversation that was started. Is when this photo was taken. So I really admire like the people who are wearing suits, and also those long socks on the person on the far left. I should have written down who all of these people are, but that is Marvin Minsky, and I can't see John McCarthy here, so maybe he's the person taking the photograph. I actually at the time, oh, look, I've got unregistered. I should buy this app. So that is Margaret Minsky. So I thought maybe Margaret Minsky, I'm partly going into the family here because I will notice that this was a 10-man operation, right? And like we're literally just looking at men here. So this is Margaret Minsky, who is actually Marvin Minsky in the picture's daughter. And she is actually a really interesting person in she's actually an interaction artist. She was one of the first people to really experiment with computer art at the MIT Media Lab. The other person who could have been taking the photograph is Gloria Radish, who was Marvin Minsky's wife, and they were sort of meeting at the time. The thing I want to sort of point out here, apart from like trying to inject some gender balance into this particular photo, is that, you know, we think of some of the other people I'm going to talk about in this first 15 minutes as these sort of like major figures, and some of them you would have heard of. But of course, the main thing that affected them all is that they'd had interaction with computers. This was 1956. It was literally slightly more than 10 years after the first vaguely computationally interesting computers have become available. And one of the reasons why they thought that this idea of artificial intelligence was even possible was just seeing and playing around with these devices again. And I mean, while we think of, I wanted to show personalities in this, but I wanted to emphasize that like this could have been a random and maybe more balanced set of people. And I wonder if they would have successfully come up with the same things, perhaps wearing long socks, I don't know. And like one of the examples here, right, is Margaret Minsky. You know, one of the reasons why she's a sort of successful interactive artist is because she obviously got the same experience, right? She grew up, I don't think it's purely or at all nepotism, right? The first generation of people thinking about these things were people who, again, as I say, had some physical access to these things, were in a conversation with this technology, which was not really accessible to anyone. I think the exception to that is probably this person who you probably have seen pictures of this. For some reason, like, there's always pictures of Alan Turing, for it is he, as a child. Fortunately, I did not fill the rest of the slides with pictures of Alan Turing as a child, but this is actually from 1928, which explains why he looks like he's a little back in time. The thing that made Alan Turing exceptional, and you'll know him, he's the father of many, many parts of computing, is that he was already formulating some of these ideas before he had an interaction with computer. Two things he's sort of most famous for, he has his name attached to, is this idea of a Turing machine. And a Turing machine is like this absolute basic simplification of a computer. And from that, he derived what computers can do and what computers can't do. It's a sort of imaginary computer that's a giant paper tape, for want of a better way to visualize it. So he was visualizing this and the computational implications of this in his head, right? He wasn't yet having the conversation. The other element, though, the other thing that Alan Turing is famous for is the Turing test. And the Turing test is a thought experiment, again, where you posit that a computer may be able to fake, may be able to pretend intelligence, right? And the way that this is usually presented is you're sitting at a terminal and you're typing words to something that is either a human or a computer, and you're trying to work out just from the terminal whether the answers you're getting are human or sufficiently human or not. And of course the computer is trying to convince you you're human. Just because we talked a little bit of about gender in this other part, the other thing that's sort of interesting about the Turing test, or Turing was not so arrogant to call it a Turing test, he called it the imitation game. And the original parlor game was that it's based on was actually a man and a woman. So you had a man and a woman in the other room, your job was to try and work out which one of them was actually the woman. The man would be pretending to be a woman, and the woman was trying to help you. And it's really unclear in the original paper whether Alan Turing was trying the version that he thought is the AI trying to be a woman, and that's the test, right? Does the AI have this sort of gendered quality? Again, like it's just an interesting theme that sort of goes through a lot of this stuff. So this is Joe Weizenbaum twice. Joe was one of the people in the AI world, and he found this whole anthropomorphization of computing very disquieting. Joseph Weizenbaum is probably the first person who built something that could in some way be used as a Turing test. He wrote a program called ELIZA in 1965, I think. And that's a better picture of him, I think. He's the guy on the right. The thing that Joe Weizenbaum was famous for is Joe was the sort of token European. And so he has a great, great book, which I will quote from in a little bit. One of the reasons why he was mad at the anthropomorphization is that he just felt that his co-workers were uncultured wretches primarily. And there's a lot of bits of his book where he's just talking about these people being up in their own sci-fi world in the nicest possible way. And anyway, Joe wrote a chatbot, the world's first chatbot. And it was, you may well know this. We can do a demo of it. Hold on. Can't click on that link. Oh, well, maybe I won't do a demo. It was originally called Doctor, and it fakes being a psychiatrist. So you go on and you type, "I am feeling sick." And the program replies, "Why are you feeling sick?" It's a very simple program, and it works on kind of the logic of artificial intelligence in the 50s and 60s, which is a thing which is basically kind of like thinking of human minds as symbolic jigsaw puzzles, right? That in the same way as you may have been taught when you were learning English how to break down the structure of a sentence. You know, you find the verb and you find the subject and you find the object, and then you deconstruct it. So the theory is that you could probably build artificial intelligence by teaching a computer to do this breakdown and this reconstruction, that it would begin, it would basically be doing symbolic processing. It would move those symbols around. And in that way, it would simulate being a human or a human thought, because the idea of humans thinking was at that point kind of situated in this idea that we're kind of like basically logical animals that move symbols around. We're not like dogs with bones. We have little slots where ideas fit, and we think in syllogisms, to be a little trivializing about it. Anyway, Doctor works really simply. It just sort of bounces back what you said. It's kind of like a therapist, but it changes some of the words. So when you say, "I am feeling depressed," it knows that I is the subject of the of the sentence, and then it flips it around and changes I to you. So then it goes, oh, so you are feeling depressed, and it knows enough about tenses to flip it around. Doesn't know anything else about it. It just has these templates where it echoes back what you're saying. Joe Weiserman was really freaked out by the fact that people would happily chat to Eliza for a long time, and with this text that's been on the screen slightly too long, he was really disturbed by how much people would talk about it. Again, I'm just going to touch on the sort of interesting gender dynamics in this, right? In the while I try to find out the other people around the Dartmouth project, we know that he had a secretary. I can't find like any record of the name of that person. And I would note that the secretary is correct in this, right? So Joe Weizenbaum is sort of sitting there going, oh my God, it's terrible that these people are actually talking and she asked to leave. And of course we know now that now we're a bit more accomplished at having conversations with computers. We frequently type things into computers that are private and should be protected from other people. Like, for instance, when you type something into Google, it's an example I often use, right? When you type something into Google, if I feel that I have, an illness, but I don't want to worry my family, I will search for it on Google, but I won't tell my family. It's actually more private to me than what I tell humans. Whereas Joe was like, oh my God, they're telling all of these private things to a computer. And when I try and record those, everyone gets mad about it. Well, Joe was right. Joe was wrong. And his secretary was right. So talking about being wrong, as I said, this early stage of artificial intelligence was really about symbolic processing. It was really, they really felt, and this actually fed into media representations of artificial intelligence in the 70s and 80s. If you've ever seen Star Trek episodes and the like, where someone, Kirk, says to the computer, what is love? And the computer goes, I cannot compute. It's because... it's because the idea was that we were going to build these computers on using logic, pure logic, and they would just think in these syllogisms. There was another school of thought in that Dartmouth meeting, which was, why don't we build, as they would say at the time, electronic brains and take what we know about brains, which is that they're neurons, that they all connect together and they're just this big jelly of interconnected things. And there's no particular, there's no logic at the physical level. You can't take out a bit of brain and go, this is the thing that fits this, that checks whether something is a verb or not, or flips it in the way of Eliza. Maybe we should emulate the hardware. And I'm keeping this picture up for a while because I don't have any other pictures and I like the colors. But this is Marvin Minsky's book, Perceptrons, that came out in 1969 and almost accidentally kind of killed that whole side inquiry, because there was a part of it that sort of mathematically proved that at least one form of neural networks weren't able to do a whole chunk of the things that Alan Turing had shown computers should be able to do and can do. So everybody drew kind of the wrong conclusion from that and decided that neural networks were never going to be able to do logic processing, do kind of language comprehension, or be an electronic brain. The truth is actually 20 or 30 years later, after what was called the AI winter, which is they went really hell for leather on this whole symbolic processing thing, got some really good chess playing machines out of it, but did not get particularly smart computers. Everybody realized that, oh, they'd gone down the wrong alleyway. And I just, again, kind of want to emphasize this because I think that sometimes we think of technology as being this wave of progress. And one of the downsides of having a small set of people is that an influential book like this can really stop her and change things. So this is an example of in the conversation the people thinking and talking about computers are actually changing the computers that were built. For many years, computers were built to do the kind of symbolic processing and not this this imitation, low-level imitation of the human mind. Until, now I remember why I had this. Until the 90s and 2000s, and they took another route, and I'm going to show you some really dumb, not artificially intelligent stuff at all, and then I'm going to show you the really interesting stuff that's happening right now. And again, one of the reasons I'm showing you the dumb stuff is partly so you won't be completely, you'll see the machinery behind the curtain a little bit. So one of the things that isn't artificially intelligent at all, but kind of touches on how neural networks work and how symbolic processing doesn't, is you could do this thing with text. Let's think about Eliza again, right? So with Eliza, you're just chopping and changing. You're just following these rules. But what if you throw out all the rules? What if instead what you do is do something really stupid and low level, which is to feed a computer program a bunch of text, right? And make it sort of basically work out the probabilities that one word is going to follow another. So if you give it a lot of conversations about my cat, then if I give it my cat dashboard is, right, it will look through all my prattlings that I say about my cat and realize that I'm usually say talkative or nice or hungry on a lot of those occasions, maybe like a third each with each of those words. And then it just throws a dice and it picks one of those words. And then what you have is a thing that can sort of generate, given a cue, like the beginnings of the rest of the conversation based on what it's seen. So in that sort of situation, I might say, my cat is, and it would say, talkative. But then it would look and say, well, what's a word that comes after talkative from my huge data set? And maybe after I say talkative, I'm usually thinking about how my cat is hungry. So maybe the sentences after that are like, maybe she's hungry. So maybe has a high probability. So you pick maybe. And then as you can see, you're beginning to generate like some text that is sort of like the reply that you saw in Eliza, but rather than the symbolic level, it's purely just chance and the probabilities of words coming through. So there's not even, we're not even faking that this computer knows what it's doing. It's literally rolling a weighted dice to choose what the words are. The interesting thing about this is if you give it a fair bit of data, this can come up with some fairly, I wouldn't say convincing, but interesting kind of variations, right? And one of the ones that, one of the party tricks that's sort of interesting to do is you can mix your data sets, right? So you take one data set from one thing and a data set from another, and you merge them together, and then you've kind of messed with the probabilities. So it could either go down one path or another. And this is, this is a good example of this. This is the approach I've called it, I've said this very simple approach is called a Markov chain. This is a Twitter bot which combines a data set of recruiter emails. If you've ever worked in the tech industry, you will realize you get a lot of spammy recruiter emails and a database of people's experience taking hardcore hallucinogenic drugs. So what this means is when you put those together, you generate things like constant innovation enables and powers all businesses across Amazon to keep him happy despite the terrible pain. Unbearable shame, public embarrassment in years of engineering management experience. And of course, you can continue to do this for as long as you want to, right? This is a frequent parlor game. So so that's one of the things that you can do with a probabilistic system. But what we found in like the early 2000s and going forward is a couple of things. One, there were huge advances in how you can build neural networks and how complicated they can be. And the second thing is because of the internet and certain companies sort of spidering of the internet, we also had a huge amount more data. So lots more fodder, not just drug experiences and recruitment emails, like the whole of Wikipedia, right? The whole of a bunch of websites. And in parallel with that, a growing sophistication about how we knew neural networks work. So the end result of this was sort of something like, people often try to be very clever when they're building artificial intelligent things. It seems like, you know, almost a prerequisite. But sometimes you can just create really interesting things by just burying these things in data. And that was the strategy that after all this cleverness in the 60s and 70s and 80s, people sort of shifted towards. And the big shift in this was in 2018. Right. So 2018, OpenAI, which actually was partly funded by Elon Musk, who is another theme that comes through this whole timeline we're in, came up with sort of like basically as an experiment in how big you can build this thing. Not only was it using a huge data set. For those of you interested, the way that they kind of passed it was they went through Reddit, and any link in Reddit that had like two or three upvotes, they followed and traced on the assumption that people wouldn't upvote spammy websites. God knows what that was doing to this potentially artificially intelligent brain. Anyway, the end result was really interesting. So the stuff here in italics is sort of the lead sentence, right? The prompt. And as you can see, it's just sort of this made up sentence about finding unicorns in the Andes mountain. And then the unicorn spoke English. The courier text, the text beneath this, from here down, is the computer-generated text, right? And there's a few things to point out. One, it's being super creative here, right? I mean, it's invented a person here. The person, it makes sense because it's the Andes. There are callbacks to this person, right? It's created a character, and then it's gone and integrated that into its story. The story continues, right? Like there is a whole narrative here, and it makes as much sense as some unicorns speaking English would do. I mean, there are some like errors that are obviously spottable, like it sort of says dialect or dialectic. And then, you know, it sort of has this like weirdness going down here. It makes sense, right? And in fact, the OpenAI team was so concerned about how smart sounding this seemed, they actually refused to publish their model. They gave these examples and then said, this is too dangerous to release on the greater internet because it's going to basically be used as an engine for misinformation and not just about unicorns. So I actually, when I was at EFF, we had kind of a fight with them about this because, I mean, one of the things is if you're going to try and defend against this sort of automatically generated misinformation, you kind of need to know what the problem is. And they were sort of like basically showing what was possible and then hiding from all the academics and researchers who were in a position to kind of tackle this, how this worked or how this behaved. So we ended up sort of talking to them a fair bit about whether to release this. And in the end, they did something that I think we all agreed was the right thing, is that they didn't release the whole model, which is very computationally complicated to create, to use anyway. But they did create a login system, a remote system that you could go and play around with these prompts. And I mean, just sort of reiterate how far we're going off from the Aeroid recruiter emails, or indeed the sort of ELIZA model. I had to cut off the first sentence here, but the first sentence here is the question is, what is your favorite pet? And GPT-3 answers, I like dogs. And the question goes on, right? And this is not, you know, I am feeling depressed. Why are you feeling depressed, right? This contains a bunch of factual information and some apparent kind of logic deduction going on. And one of the things that's sort of fascinating about GPT-3 is constructing these prompts becomes like the main way you program these systems, right? You Hello.
Hello.
Hello, I'm back. Are you all...
Hey, Danny, I can hear you well, if that's what you're trying to figure out.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay. So can you still see my screen? Probably not. Let me do that again. So it has this logic and also crafting these prompts. So basically the reason why it's answering questions about facts is because the prompt is this QA construction, right? So the Q is kind of the person typing in the text and the A's are the replies, but the thing that sort of cues in the GPT-3 that it's supposed to answer in these forms is because Q&As have this structure, right? And you can kind of use different prompts to create different things. I can't kick up the website. Never mind. Well, maybe I can. Hold on. Okay, I can't quite show you that, unfortunately. Oh, yeah, actually I can. There we go. So these are some of the examples of sort of prompts that you can put into it. And I think one of the things to sort of convey here, right, is so we have this we have the same sort of Q&A structure here, but you cue it to say that this is a list of spelling corrections, right? So the bit in black at the top here, just around here, if you can see it, is the thing that the user has put in. So this bit here, and then the red bit kind of continues the pattern of that prompt, right, and corrects the spelling. Similarly here, right, you say poor English and then you say corrected English, and after a few examples GPT-3 begins to understand what you want. Same with title casing, right? So no one taught GPT-3 to do this kind of spelling correction, in the same way as after a few examples GPT-3 begins to know how to translate text. Not always correctly, right? One of the things to convey here is that in the same way as the Erowid recruiter sometimes completely goes off the rails, so does GPT-3. So this is GPT-3 learning how to program, right? So this is an English description of what this text is supposed, this what you would say in English, and it's gradually learning from a few examples because it already knows a whole stuff about computer programming because it's sort of sucked in all of these larger corpuses. Example of this used in somewhat real life, is this, right? So Hunter will recognize this slightly mad email that I wrote at 2 o'clock in the morning. So we were trying to work out what we should call the Decentralized Future Council, because I'd thrown my usual tantrum over not using the term Web3. I think it was called the Web3 Fellows at some point, or the Web3 Frontier Fellows. Anyway, I said, can we come up with a different name? After kicking around a few ideas, I fed this prompt. Let's get it right. So my prompt here was down to let's see here, right? So so everything above this I typed in. And so you can see that, like, I fed it with some conservative think tanks, right? Because I wanted it to have an example, but it was an example that was a little bit broader than the usual ones. We have some seed words about what we're trying to convey, and then this is what should be generated. And so I put in the description, some examples of what this think tank should be about. Some sort of seed words for what we want to convey, and then it generates all of this stuff. So there's some good stuff here: the Internet Freedom Coalition, the Decentralized Web Foundation, the Interplanetary File System. We should try and use that sometime. And then some stuff that's less useful, like Satoshi's Roundtable, the University of Pump and Dump. And you can see at the end, eventually it gets a little obsessed with hard forks, which is an occupational hazard in our space. The final one we settled on was actually the single answer that Hunter wrote 30 seconds before I did this, which was the Decentralized Future Council. But, you know, even though Hunter beat the machine this time, there's a few things in here that were not dissimilar. Okay, so we had a look at some examples. All right, so I'm going to have to flip up a little bit. So We've talked a little here about text, but the basic principle of this, which is you feed a ton of data into these things, and then you say, predict what's going to happen next, can work in other contexts too. So this is, and also it kind of gets consumerized, right? OpenAI is now more open, ironically. Apparently the world didn't collapse when they provided general access to their systems. Tools that are based on GPT-3 are slowly spreading and being used. In fact, one of the people that we have talked to very briefly, who's doing a entirely open version of GPT-3, which of course involves all of this data, is actually talking about, like, whether it makes sense to store a lot of that data on the Filecoin network. But as I say, like, you can apply this principle in different ways. So I'm just going to say it's kind of bad at cats, but maybe we'll say, now I'm stuck, but maybe we can say computers talking to happy owners in the 50s. I've not done this before. I'm making this up as I go along. And this is, I should emphasize also, kind of like, it's cheap, right? This is an app you can get, and they have to save computing costs, so they do not invest a lot into this. So what category? I think Vibrant is pretty good, actually. Okay, so it's going to run, and again, what it's doing is you can see it's sort of feeding stuff into itself and creating something based on that idea, and gradually oscillating until it feels that this is a predictable image. That's not super good. This never quite works out, right? So let's try another one. And of course, you can keep running this, right? There we go. So there's a recognizable person, it isn't very good at eyes, but it's pretty good at computers. And of course, as you saw, like, it's it's doing this in a particular style, so we can change the style, right? So let's give one of these examples here. We can say do, and then maybe as an etching, it's probably a bad combination. And you can download this app and just play around with yourself. There we go. Okay. And again, what it's doing is it's probabilistically trying to get closer and closer to something that is predictably what you would recognize as this particular image. Again, I should emphasize that you should not take any of the things that I describe as like accurate descriptions of the mathematics behind this kind of thing. What I'm really doing is, again, talking about what this conversation is like when you're talking to a pet. I'm not describing, you know, how a pet's liver works or anything like this. The reason why I bring this up is partly because it gives you an example of how this isn't just about text, that as computers now can pass and process all kinds of things, not just text, they can do this predictive thing in other spaces. The other reason why I wanted to do it is because I wanted to bring you up to date. So DALL-E is the next project that came out of OpenAI. Daniel Baskin, if you want somebody to like explore more this side of OpenAI, Daniel Baskin does an amazing job creating prompts to get the best out of this kind of project. Daniel got access, which we don't have, to DALL-E, and DALL-E is sort of what you just saw on steroids. It's got a much more refined, larger set of skills in creating these images. And so what Daniel created is a sort of alternative timeline for San Francisco. Just to be clear, the San Francisco Golden Gate Bridge does not have trains on it. It's a car and a pedestrian bridge, and it goes to a very twee city on the other side of the San Francisco Bay, which if you come to our retreat next week, you will see it doesn't look anything like this. It's single buildings. This is a fantasy where we have decent public transport in San Francisco, and also we have decent public housing. And you can see all of these images are DALL-E generated, right? And here's one where it's not only simulating what these high rises would look like in Marin County, but it's also creating it in this these 1970s style. And just again to kind of reiterate, the text, what you use to generate this is you just use these prompts, right? So this is all you need to create these images, and it will elucidate what that is. Okay, so we're almost at the end. I just wanted to for those of you who thought I was going to talk about artificial general intelligence, there is artificial intelligence has probably been a misnomer since the 1950s. But it is a continuing conversation. And if I had another hour, I would happily tell you about the train of anthropological thought that went through all of this from John McCarthy and Mitski to the present day, about where you get from here to what's called artificial general intelligence, which is somebody that isn't just pretending to be a human, but is so close to pretending that it actually is a human. Although that's a little bit of a philosophical rat hole. One of the things though we have is, let's see if I can switch tabs very smoothly. So we have access to the AI prompt system. This is a personal one, but I actually finagled a Filecoin one, which I can give us all accounts on. And I think one of the things that let me just show you kind of where we are with this. So for those of you who've ever messed around with programming, you'll recognize that strange hieroglyphics here where we go, this is a comment, right? This is what human beings type in at the front of their code before they write the code to try and document what it is. This is called Codex, but it's based on the same kind of technology, is like down page and search it for the word and I am a little terrified because when I do demos like this, they don't always work. Okay. So this is pretty good, right? So this is generating the results of the whole thing. It's not actually searching for it. So let me see if I can just tweak this a little bit. So it's taking a description and turning it into to code. And this is something that programmers are now actually using, right? So Microsoft did a deal with the OpenAI people. Now if you use their editor that's sort of linked into GitHub, it will let you do this, right? It will let you take comments and generate it. You can do other things like in the same way as we had the thing with finding typos, it will look at your code and then maybe it will find a bug. Maybe it will inject a bug, right? You still have to like monitor the whole thing. But you can, with the proviso that this costs like a few cents every time you do this, so don't go crazy because it's on my credit card, you can play around with this as much as you want. Let's see. You see some of these sort of examples, right, that we used for, right? So what will happen if we do this? There you go. If you can, if that font is too small, let me bring it. Oops, wrong way. So again, it's taken this, it's passed all of this, and then it's turned it into a simpler text. So that's kind of the treat at the bottom of this today's talk. We've got like 5 minutes for questions, and you can ask me for gossip about John McCarthy and Marvin Minsky. Liz actually was John McCarthy's archivist at Stanford for a few years, so I can exclusively reveal here that he does have a tendency to write very bad science fiction, and that is a common theme amongst many of these folks. But I can also do a little bit more explaining on the technical side if you want that too. But that's it. And yeah, just email me if you want access to the OpenAI account. Any questions? Please say something. I sound like Jeb Bush, but please say something just so I haven't been talking like with no one hearing me for like the last 15 minutes.
Thank you, Danny. I thoroughly enjoyed your presentation.
Thank you very much.
I wanted to let you know. Very much so appreciated and loved the visual aids. This
I know. Like I'm so I do sort of mean this about the conversation as a theme. It's really worth playing around with this because I think that one of the things that you sort of see when you see the examples is you both kind of, they seem a little bit set up, a little bit pre-set up. And also they they also fail in what appear to be obvious ways. So you go, well, this isn't really like, you know, that's not a great picture of Sausalito. And yet when you play around with it, one of the things I would totally recommend you doing with the OpenAI thing is having a conversation with a historical figure. This is a great thing. You say at the beginning, and you say, this is an interview with, you know, Ada Lovelace or Ben Franklin or what have you. And it will do a reasonable simulacrum of a conversation. And you can throw in contemporary events. So you can ask Ben Franklin what he thinks of Filecoin or cryptocurrency. And you'll get a Ben Franklin answer-ish back. It's a little freaky.
That's fascinating. I feel like this is going to be my new dinner trick. When I come to dinner fried with Z and I don't have anything to converse with him about, I'm going to just be like, we're just going to invite Ben to dinner tonight.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So, and, you know, I think that we're at the point now, I said very early on, where, like, you know, one of the things that gives people a sort of insight into what's coming next is to play around with these things. And I think what you're going to see is sort of somewhat of a wave of the commercial ends of that. So the image generator, the that we showed, which is an app, is available. It's not hidden or anything. The tech stuff tends to not be, because we talk a lot about algorithmic bias and AI bias. And one of the things about these things is that if you talk to them in a certain way, then they will echo back. So if you start saying toxic things and feed toxic things into it, it will start responding in a toxic way. And also, like I say, it can sometimes sort of go completely off the rails. And that means that OpenAI and almost any organization that values its reputation is never going to let this thing interact directly with customers, because a trollish customer could ask it what it thinks of, you know, the protocols of the Elders of Zion, and it would start ranting. But also, it might just end up accidentally falling that way, right? It would. I think to sort of bring this back to sort of decentralization a little bit, one of the things that I feel is that this dynamic of having this to play with yourself and having you under the complete control sort of changes that that dynamic. Because if it's rude to me, I'm controlling it, right? I control what goes into it. I can filter and move it away from those things, and I can target it. I think it's fundamentally important that we have control of, you know, these things should be our pets, right? Rather than a bulldog that was trained by somebody else, or worse, a bulldog that was trained by the entirety of Reddit. And because that's, I think, one of the reasons why you get these kind of biases and things coming in. Any more questions? All right, pop into Slack. I think I'm going to start a Danny Talk Slack or something like that. But you can message me, and I'll give you an OpenAI account. And I do occasionally use it in my everyday life, but I'm not going to tell you which bits of the things that I write are actually written by GPT-3. But it's sometimes, you know, you're writing a press release, you kind of know where it's going, so you just let it finish it off. There's a couple of EFF white papers that it helped with. All right.
Thanks, Danny.
Thank you.
Thank you, Danny.
See you soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Danny.
Bye. Thank you, Danny. Bye.